Back to collecting unconscious. She talks about what symbols are. On 81-82, the reason she gets into that is that we have the proper vocabulary to understand what the collective, how the collective unconscious functions. She's saying that in the one understanding within the Christian development of consciousness, by that I mean the way our mind developed after paganism, is that images were either thought to be physical, a picture of something physical, like the mandala would be the nipple, or totally spiritual, that the image represents some aspect of God. And what she's saying is the collective unconscious is between the two. It's an attempt to do justice to the to facts and reality and to the meaning of things. But it, I think for us, maybe the really important thing is we remember Jung's distinction between sign and symbol. So our normal use of those words gets us confused, because what we learned, let's say in Psych 101, that a steeple is a phallic symbol, would actually in Jung's language be a phallic sign. A sign is something that is known. I always try to put these in my own words, and I would say a sign is a representative of something that is either known or has been known. So if I have a temper, I might dream of a storm. That storm would be a sign of my temper. It could be that I admit that I have a temper. It could be that I don't admit I have a temper. And either case, it's a sign. What is signaled is something that either is or has been known. That's a sign. Where a symbol is a picture of something that has never been known. It is not known, and it has never been known. I think the clearest one we've seen regularly is that picture Carol drew, you remember that, of the snake in the mosque? When that was painted, we didn't know there would be an Arab Spring. So that was a symbol of the Arab Spring. That Arab Spring has never happened in history before. Now that we know about the Arab Spring, that painting is a sign. So the symbol is always related to the future, to something that hasn't been, where a sign is related to the past and has been.
So a symbol is never quite knowable, though.
It's not knowable until it's knowable.
Until it's known.
Yeah, until it's known. And then it becomes a sign.
So in individual work, are we searching, we're hoping for a symbol to come up in the individual that
absolutely.
The transcendent function
absolutely.
Then changes that individual person.
Right.
But once you understand that symbol, then it is a sign.
It's a sign, yeah. And in our work, we're looking for both signs and symbols.
Okay.
But I think, and here's where Jung adds, the real healing responses of the psyche are symbols. How do you know whether to treat an image as a sign or a symbol? That's the art of the work. I guess I tend to start out looking at them as signs, but pretty soon you feel like you're banging your head into a wall. And so I know, okay, let's take a different approach here. We're getting nowhere.
But she does say, if I understand her, that there is something in the symbol that's never quite knowable.
Did she say that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did.
In the very middle of 82, right before footnote 8.
And then at the bottom, too.
And then she sort of, in a way, contradicts herself.
Yeah, I think she does, too, yeah. Go ahead.
But, I mean, maybe she's just not being as specific as she could be. She says, once the meaning is born out of
right. Mm-hmm. That's what I was focusing on.
Then, she talks about being able to kill it. Mm-hmm. But there must be some essence to it that she's not really referring to.
Well, if you kill it.
It relates to the archetype.
If you kill it, it'll kill you.
That you can't be killed.
Right.
That it's just a structure, a factor.
Maybe it's manifestation at the moment can be killed.
Yeah, that's why it seems like she's saying, but she doesn't really refine the idea that much. She just, assumes that you know that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that like the integration of a projection? Like, Zeus was a symbol, right? Mm-hmm. But now that he's dead to us, mm-hmm. The idea of Zeus is just dead, and there's nothing in it,
right.
Other than historically isn't that interesting. So I think...
But the Zeus never died.
Correct. So the archetype never dies, but as a symbol... It's over for him,
right.
Like we'll have to have a new symbol, and that one never will be resurrected, or maybe even like Christ. I think.
Absolutely, I mean that's the subtext here, which she doesn't come out and say.
And
we tend to fight wars, I think, is when we're trying to keep our little symbol alive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not dead; it's still alive.
I'll kill you to make sure it stays alive.
Well, it could be possible that Christianity hasn't totally died because we haven't gotten all the meaning out of it. Yeah,
right.
It's still alive as long as it has some meaning. Mm-hmm.
Well, the projection hasn't been integrated,
right.
So it's, mm-hmm. it's still
right.
got
something
meaning.
That needs to be carried over into the next.
Well, I would say for some people it is dead mm-hmm. and can be integrated. For others, it is not dead mm-hmm. and can't be integrated.
But I wonder if this is why Jung was so reluctant to be done with Christianity, because he knew that there was the spark in there that needed to be brought.
Well, I think two reasons. One, he didn't want to mess with people's minds who need it. And two, the danger of saying it's dead, none of us here would say that, but some people might say, well, I can just forget it and move on. Rather than saying, what is it as an inner structure that I must now begin to work on?
So that would be the fourth and the fifth.
Yes, right. See how we're sort of start now. We're starting to get the same ideas on a spiral. Yeah.
Yeah, because to me, after studying Jung, he sort of rebirthed Christ as example.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And where it had been dead as a Catholic.
As a literal. Historical significant figure. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think, and he did not want us to let the truths go, but to see on what level they applied. Very much so. And I think that separates him out from all of European thought during his life. I mean, everyone was just saying, God is dead, God is dead, God is dead.
Later on, she seems to say it hinges on maintaining a childlike attitude and staying open.
Well, what hinges on?
What a symbol has to offer.
Yeah.
That it can, I suppose that also points to the idea that it can transform. So if you stay open to it, like you're talking about staying open, the symbol of Christ was in a way renewed, but after staying open, it seems like she's emphasizing that openness and childlike attitude.
That we can...
Scientific scrutiny kills.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And by killing, she means it offers no more.
Right.
But the actual symbol, I don't think she means is itself is dead. It's our relationship to it.
Or its particular formulation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm just puzzled by that statement of hers that... and I do think she, by the way, contradicts herself, that it is never quite knowable... I think it is. But what is not knowable is that it contains this drive to the future. maybe that's a way to reconcile these two statements.
That you don't know where it's taking
you? Well, that whatever it is that's making these images so intelligent, you can't grasp. You just have to have the openness to, and I hesitate, I wouldn't use the word faith, I think I would say you have the openness to try it and see if you follow this line where it will get you. So that's sign and symbol. I like what she says. It's easy to understand the resistance of the churches to psychological interpretations. Bottom 83. You know, there's a whole movement in churches to bridge Christianity and Jung. But what they want to do, they want to bridge Christianity in the old understanding and Jung. They don't want to let go of the certainty and treat Christianity as a form. They still treat it as a metaphysical truth. And then it can't be joined with Jung. So I think we got it. Over to 84.
It's interesting. I know an evangelical Christian. He was saying, I guess, at this big church that he's, or he used to belong to, they, I think, wanted to do away with the cross, because, you know, it's become such a sort of trivialized. So I think in a way they're realizing it's been made a sign and it's lost its symbolic meaning.
But he's going to have to give up looking for any definitive representative of his truth. But on the other hand, just on the importance of Christianity, I don't think I've ever seen a fundamentalist Christian. I don't see many of them, but now and then they pop in here. Who wasn't a psychopath. And you know, you thank God they have this veneer of decency, because if they didn't, many of them have, you know, are wife beaters. I mean, there's always some very, very dark, horrible aspect to them. And then they just cover it up with the sweetness. But the sweetness does give them some control.
A friend of mine and I were walking the other day in Broderfield, and she didn't know, she was watching with the question. This guy came, some kind of fundamentalist, you know, and it was like, God loves you, and he just kept going on and on. And my friend, who's, you know, very kind, just had this immediate negative reaction to this guy, like, get away from me. And she goes, I've never felt like that before in my life. And he would not leave her alone. And I mean, she was, I don't know what it was about this guy, but it was something, and she felt kind of bad, because it was something that felt really creepy and off about him. And I said, if it feels that way, it is that way. But he was this very fundamentalist, you know, God loves you kind of thing. But, you know, under that, there was just, like, I mean, there was something really off about the dude, in spite of his words and his...
You're feeling the psychopath.
Yeah.
You mentioned the implication that he's saying that she thinks God doesn't love her.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, people are like, I need you to remind me, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was the same thing. He was very creepy under this, you know, God loves you, the words and the music did not match. And, you know, she had this very visceral sense of it, but that was just it, like... She goes, and she didn't understand quite her reaction to him. But I said, you know, it was on target. The guy was a creep, and I don't give a flying fuck what he said. You know, he's a creep.
Right, yeah. And to me, that's like the whole issue of good and evil. I'm going to talk about that. And then, you know, when it's so divided, like that, separated like that, you know, I mean, it's just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's unhealable. Unhealable.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, it's not, you know, it's not... you know, it's so unconscious in him that, you know,
yes,
that
exactly.
Somebody else has, and then it just becomes on its own. I mean, it becomes so separate that, you know, it really can do what it wants to do. But that's what, to me, and then he only helps so much with relativizing those, connecting those two.
That's a classic, and a good way of describing it. We don't want to throw it out, we don't want to identify with it. We see it as an inner process.
Yeah, we're getting the demons soon. So
yeah. Okay, 84. She picks up there this, let me see if I can pick out a sentence. Go kind of about the middle of that paragraph under the section, the multiple unity. She uses the phrase the concentric or radial order. That's what I was trying to get at earlier, that we begin to see how these different experiences can, on further awareness, be seen as getting us somewhere.
And where are you?
I see. 84. I just tried to pick out one phrase to sum up that whole paragraph.
Okay. Where is
it? Page 84. Let's see. Go down 1, 2, 3.
Oh,
four. See it?
Yeah.
Concentric or radial order, which constitutes the true center or essence of the collective unconscious. Now, I think that sums up that page.
Do you think that could, even that description, could be symbolic of a previous worldview?
I think it is, yes.
Because I've had dreams of the collective unconscious as a field, as opposed to something, you know, an energy field. As opposed to something like radial and sense and the center.
Certainly, this is an interiorization of the old idea of the wisdom of God, I would say. Mm-hmm. That she's seeing it as an inner process. Yes, I think it can manifest itself in a whole variety of idioms. One is in religion. The other, which is why her first two chapters were on science and religion, are in images of science.
So are you seeing, you know, as a professional, different representations of this center that seem new to you?
No. Doesn't mean they don't exist, but I may not have recognized them. But now, go back to the chapter on science. Remember all the images she talked about. Circle, the spark, the... Well, anyway. What... The subtext there is that science is a projection of the self. Or scientific imagery has carried our projection of the self. And just like it's time to withdraw projections from God, so it's time to withdraw projections from science. And that's where the self has parked itself on our scientific theories. So it is not surprising that the way the self would come to us is an imagery typical of scientific theories. Definitely.
And you're saying you've seen it as in dreams as a field of energy rather than a circle.
See, it could be a field of energy, it could be a circle, it could be a spark.
But that relates to our modern, our, you know, the edge of our science right now. So just as much as, you know, phase or bad of looking at it, I would say.
But I think the emotional point she's trying to make is just as we can look to religion as a place that's carried self-images, so we can look to science as a place that's carried self-images. And that is the way the self makes itself conscious. So what we have to do now is begin integrating those images. What's my inner field? What's my inner circle? What's my inner spark? And so on.
And how it's evolving, right? I
mean, and that will allow it to evolve. Now, whether the progress of science is dependent on that, I don't know. Maybe it is.
So unless it's seen and that projection is pulled back in, there's no progress for the self.
Right. No progress for the self. And, you know, I... Of course, having studied engineering and all, we we had courses in like science and society. And if you read the criticism of science and technology, at least up until 10 years ago, it may have changed, but I doubt it. Basically, it says we shouldn't go to excess. That's like telling somebody you shouldn't have an affair. It doesn't work. So I think what she is bringing up is these scientific, technological, and religious structures have so much power because they carry aspects of our personality. And to make changes in the way we live will mean withdrawing projections from them so that they don't have the power they used to have. You could say, what are we projecting onto healthcare? What are we projecting onto any aspect of our technological environment, relationship to the environment would be aspects of the self, and we will not be able to change our compulsiveness there until we begin withdrawing these projections. I believe that's what she's, what she's saying between the lines here. Let's see. Subtle body. She almost lost me there.
Yeah.
Page 85. She's saying, is the old idea of the subtle body the same as the collective unconscious? Remember, don't forget to loop. That might be my cell phone. I may have gotten attached. I don't know.
Same as
wow, I've got to be.
She's
kind of
weird.
For whom the bell tolls.
The subtle body
speaks. That's it, the subtle body speaks. I better watch what I say here. Well, she was saying the subtle body isn't the same as the collective unconscious. So maybe it is.
She's saying it's the thing between matter and psyche, or between an area in between where the two connect, right?
I believe the old idea is the subtle body is a kind of a soul that resides within us. And that is the primary fact of our existence. Our physical body is the manifestation of the condition of that subtle body. So, it's darn close to some of the things we say. So that, if I have a certain disease, I would look how that disease is a manifestation of what's wrong with my subtle body. Does that sound right? And she's saying, in a way we do sort of think like that. But what she wants to distinguish is that picks up one sphere, the soul, or whatever this subtleness is, and makes it primary, and she doesn't want to do that. We don't know what is primary. Is it matter? Does matter have a soul? Or does soul have a matter? She just wants to keep the question open, that's all.
More than a boundary phenomenon is what you're trying to emphasize against what I said, right?
Maybe. what do I mean by more than a boundary phenomenon?
You talked about soul.
Yeah.
So not simply the area between matter and
psyche,
but more than that.
Right. She's just saying, let's keep that question open.
Having a principle or activity or purpose behind it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Again, I think it's a very helpful concept, but she doesn't want to limit our understanding of the collective unconscious to that. Because it could be a manifestation of matter for all we know.
Well, they did weigh that person they did at death, and then before death and then after death. And he did weigh that. Is it
21 grams?
Is that really? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I was just reading that it was some kind of a science that does that.
Yeah.
I've heard that. Yeah. Anyway, not to deny that fact, but it's sort of like, so which comes first? And they would say, well, soul, that comes first, and then the body's the emanation of that. But again, I think it has some relevance to our work, but she doesn't want to say, well, that what they mean by the subtle body is what Jung means by the collective unconscious. It's just sort of a parenthesis she's putting in there.
She says they're not the same thing.
It's not a boundary phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah.
And then she called it transcendental.
Okay, Dawn, where's that?
The end of the first paragraph, like four lines up from the end of the first
far
paragraph.
Far likelier to be omnipresent, and its timelessness points to some kind of purely transcendental existence.
You know, when she uses these words, you always got to figure out what does she mean by them. And she doesn't always use them in the same way. That's what's a little confusing. I think here she means we don't know where it resides. And that next statement, I prefer to remain within the context of what is demonstrable, meaning these thoughts are nice, but until we can show data to support them, she prefers not to reach any final conclusions. In other words, she's saying, I'm taking a scientific attitude toward this thing.
So I guess she's also saying she sees no physical qualities. Because the old idea is the subtle body.
The subtle body, because she does say, here, psychoid, similar to psychological, similar to matter.
Yeah, but then she says purely transcendental.
I know. I agree with that. Like, that sounds like that has something to do with matter, right? That's transcendental, that is non-material.
Exactly.
No, but I don't think it does mean that. I think in the standard use of the word transcendental does mean that.
Okay.
But see, Jung would say matter is transcendental.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Meaning it appears to have a intelligence of its own apart from my ego as evidence in synchronicity. So both the spirit for Jung and matter are transcendental.
So I guess that totally goes against my understanding of the word transcendental.
Yeah, and what's so confusing, they tend to, they're intuitives, and they use words the way they damn well feel like it. And you have to sort of figure out, what are they talking about? And the way you figure it out is look what comes before and after.
They use it in a relative way, depending on...
Yeah.
It's kind of very contextual.
Yeah, it's very contextual. And once you know, Jung called matter transcendental. But in saying so, he is really redefining what we mean by transcendental.
Yes.
And he does so in complete good conscience. Because he thinks using transcendental to mean spiritual ignores the transcendental aspect of matter.
Okay. So it transcends both spirit and matter.
Well, it transcends the ego in the sense that both the spirit and matter can show a teleological function.
Yes.
That's what they're driving at, I think.
to throw this in the mix, I just happened to be reading Edward Edgar's Psyche and Antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
And this sentence just popped out when I was reading the material. He says, Greek philosophy is based on the faith that reality, this our bodies, I took it to be, is divine, and that the one thing needful is for the soul, which is akin to the divine, to enter into communion with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of wraps everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it makes the body of this holy vessel, matter, spirit, nature.
Yes, I hadn't realized that. But when the Greeks saw a storm, they would say Poseidon has come down and entered the ocean. And Jung, so what they do is they, vivify, or they spiritualize, or... give life to matter. And that's what Jung thinks a synchronicity is. Now, we don't know whether, we don't know what is doing it, but he goes back to that early concept that the material world can carry a symbolic significance. That might be a way to put what he means by transcendental, that both the both images and matter can carry symbolic experience. Where we used to say, oh no, it's only the mind that operates with symbols. So the mind is transcendental to the body. And you would say, well, but wait a minute, matter can operate as symbols, and what it's transcendental to is not matter, but to the ego.
We think of transcendent, it always seems like it's going up, and it's really eminent in something.
Well, it goes up and down. Yeah, the transcendence both is an ascent and a descent. I know, part of the problem here is he's really redefining some words, but once you understand his thought process, I think he would say, he's really getting at the deeper meaning of the word. Yeah. Why would we think transcendental is spiritual? Right. Well, we do, but he's saying, wait a minute, why?
Right.
So, yeah.
Because we think matter isn't.
So because we think matter isn't, yeah.
Got it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think then that's pretty much that page. The archetypes, she talks about, you know, different ones, the hero, et cetera, great mother, blah, blah. We've already done that kind of stuff. she goes into a new point, page 86, at the middle. Again, we've talked about it. Jung surmised that an archetype in its quiet state is not projected. So when it is projected, it is not in a quiet state. Brilliant deduction. Why is it not in a quiet state? Because it wants to be known. So projection is the way an archetype wants to be known. Another way to put it is projection is the means by which consciousness is formed. I'll give you a classic example. I've got a, some of you know, I have a friend who's in, doing a residency in psychiatry, and she's got a guy who's fallen in love with her. And her supervisor said, well, that's a defense. That's his infantility trying to turn you into a mother. This is the way he protects himself against adulthood. And she said, no, he's falling in love with me because I represent his future. Mm-hmm. Two different interpretations. Mm-hmm. And to the credit, her supervisors were Freudian. But to his credit, he said, well, let's see where this goes. So that's how we would see many projections as symbols. And he was interpreting it as a sign. And then the deeper meaning for the way the collective unconscious works is archetypes are the way we become conscious. And you've got to be so careful that you don't say it's an error. It's an error, but it's an error that's trying to get you somewhere.
Yeah, so it depends on how concrete, the more concrete you take it, the more an error you say. Yeah.
Right. It would have, as far as therapy goes, it would have a practical significance. Whether the person can work apart from the concrete.
Yes.
If a person can't, and you find this in certain personalities, then you would have to say, oh, this is an infantile act on your part. Stop it before it gets out of hand. Right. So I think that's a big point, and it really distinguishes Jung from others, that these archetypal factors actually use what the Freudians call a defense mechanism to become conscious. Just a little detail, insight to how our mind works. Let's go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up. 86.
bottom?
Yeah. The points of the electromagnetic field can be charged to continue the comparison with physics. That's all I wanted to point out. How she not only goes to myth, but she goes to physics for her analogies. So she's broadening, again, the scientific world as useful for metaphoric thinking. And then on 87, continuing that idea and interpretation, the collective unconscious can start a movement on a mass scale on its own. We saw that in Carol's painting, An Arab Spring, that snake. I felt symbolized the rage that has broken out, and that just comes out of the collective unconscious. Mm-hmm. It just does it of its own accord.
Where are you there?
Well, I'm sort of paraphrasing the first paragraph on 87. She uses the word words. Let me get that straight. Points of the electromagnetic field, which is a concept in physics, as a metaphor for there are certain activations of the collective unconscious which surface in history.
So I guess that touches on the amoral aspect.
Yes.
Of the self. Now, would you say that that amoral aspect, when we speak of the self that way, are we talking about the unconscious self?
Yes.
And so when we speak of the self in the Grail terms as an inner court of justice, so we're speaking of the conscious self?
Well, I think it has both aspects. The unconscious self has both aspects.
Well, what I mean is, the unconscious self is, you're saying, is then amoral and yet at other times not?
Yes.
That it makes moral judgments even though it's unconscious?
It makes moral judgments even though it's unconscious, and it makes horrendously immoral, produces horrendously immoral aspects. It does both. That's why he calls it a...
Now, are you saying you're moral, not amoral? Then?
Well, probably amoral is a better word.
Okay. Well, that was my question. I think I touched upon it last week. About whether when it seems to be making a moral judgment for the benefit of society, if that is considered, if that kind of activity is only seen when that certain aspect of the self is conscious or consciousness is related to it.
I think it does it on its own accord. The question is whether it gets translated into reality.
Well, that's where the consciousness
is. Yeah. Yeah. Just because it makes a moral judgment doesn't mean that we will behave morally.
Well, then, it makes it difficult to talk in terms of an amoral self. Perhaps it's the fact that we just haven't understood.
That's certainly an argument that people make. I was kind of with, I can't see any hidden value in Auschwitz.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, if you're crushed under the wheel, how is that not understanding a moral perspective?
Now, remember when we did Zarathustra, Jung felt that Zarathustra, if he could be understood, would have led to the creation of a new world. Mm-hmm. So you could say, there was a potential for goodness,
but
still all hell broke loose. So left to its own accord, it was destructive. I don't think you can talk about this without contradicting yourself and without entertaining contradictory suppositions. And for me, that's the value of Jung's work, because everyone else I know tries to pretty it up. And it's not pretty. It's a mess. But it can work for decency if the ego gets involved. You know, we see animals who act morally. Remember we talked about it,
the ape, or that
buck that was it a deer or a moose buck that protected the goose whose mate had died and she was sitting on her eggs and he stood guard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, now you can say, well, let's say an ape nurtures a child. That's instinctive behavior. She just got confused whether it was a child or an ape. But where in nature do we see bucks guarding geese?
Mm-hmm. There must be a feeling function
that
operates in them.
I think it's better than ours.
Mm-hmm.
There's that horrible video, I don't know if you've ever seen it, about the morality of animals. And it's gruesome, and it ends with a video of a murder in New York City, and the guy's laying on the street dying. People just walk past him, and then it shoots to an animal. I think it was maybe a squirrel or something, whose partner had gotten killed in the freeway, and the mate, at complete risk to its life, would run out, pull it back a little bit, car come by, and it would zip away. Traffic would get clear, we went out and pulled its dead mate back a little bit, pulling its mate slowly. When a car come by, it would go back, protect itself, and then come back. And it struggled for half an hour getting this dead squirrel across to away from the car. Who's moral here? Yeah. And I think that shows up in the moral aspect of the self. That aspect is also part of the self. Well, let's see. Where do we get? Not too bad, huh? We didn't get through the whole chapter. We got through 10 pages. I guess let's say we let off after the first paragraph on page 87. I think it should be clear how the collective unconscious can shape history. That's another way to put it. That it seems to initiate behaviors on a mass scale.
Well, the one point she makes there too is sometimes it changes because it's external,
and
then sometimes it's internal.
And sometimes it's you could say, Arab Spring is a reaction to decades of repression, but yet it shows up in a dream, mm-hmm. and then it appears in reality as if it's there's something independent going on. In any case, the point is how external group movements can be seen to be motivated by an inner process.
I'm just thinking too, Jung's reinterpretation of what happened between Yahweh and Job.
Yes.
I mean, to me, that's a whole leap forward that it, I don't know how that came up in him, certainly he said he felt compelled. He had a demon that wouldn't stop writing it, and then so something compelled him to write that and reinterpret it. And that, if enough people read that, it would certainly make an impact on our moral
right.
Bible.
Yeah, I think you could say it. Image in the collective unconscious motivated Jung to write that. I mean, you say he just wrote it in a fever, didn't even think about it. And that is not personal to Jung, because it's a shift in consciousness that is there for all of us to make. Seeing the really, in a way, what Carol was talking about, the moral ambivalence of God.
And that it's trying to evolve to a more conscious...
Right. Well, see, we're right up to 94 today. We'll certainly finish that next time. How much to say? I should read, what, 107?
Mm-hmm.
87, where do we stop? I don't think we're going to get past 107. If we do, we'll kick back and not stress ourselves. So, yeah, I would say don't read anything. We'll shoot for this way. Is there a nice little... Why don't you read to 110, just in case. Now, what she's going to do now is start looking at images of the collective unconscious. So we've gone from projection to what is projected, the collective unconscious, to images of the collective unconscious. Will be images of the collective unconscious in its destructive aspect, and then the next one will be images of the collective unconscious in its creative aspect. Next chapter after the demons. Give you some, not to lose the thread of the book, because there is so much detail in it. Have a happy Saturday.
Thank you. Collection of images. Just tell the story.
Thank you, Gary.
Thanks for hanging in there.
You could not find any redeeming value in that, but would you not say that since World War II
and we began to reflect on what are we capable of, but I think I'd be careful in saying that was the meaning of the event.
Punishment, which I don't believe,
right.
But I do believe that it brought forward a conservative age, and it actually was very much in the end a positive for gay marriage. I mean, we've made more strides than we had before, even though people...
And more strides in what?
At least there is funding for...
Oh, I see.
There has been, even though we can't marry, we can at least get, then I can get something that says she is my...
I want to see that.
We don't have many strides to make, but some of those strides, I think,
Well, keep that in mind and bring that up as we talk about it.